second case on our docket this morning is 23-50303, the Heidi Group, Inc. versus Mr. Johnson. Ms. Jackson.
Thank you. May it please the court, the district court's denial of immunity was wrong for at least three reasons. First, Heidi Group cannot establish a violation of law because no government official conducted a Fourth Amendment search. Second, Heidi Group has not shown a clearly established privacy right in documents that it continuously shared with private third party and that it contracted to provide to agency employees at any time. And in fact, it did provide to agency employees during the course of multiple investigations and audits. And third, Heidi Group has not shown that any OIG employees' receipt of third-party disclosures was objectively unreasonable, given Heidi Group's years of financial mismanagement. This court should reverse a remand with instructions to dismiss the remaining claims. First, Heidi Group has not plausibly alleged a Fourth Amendment violation. A search under the Fourth Amendment includes two primary component parts: a violation of an expectation of privacy done by a government official. I'll start with the threshold government official requirement before we move to the expectation of privacy discussion. Here, Heidi Group admits that no government official searched its systems, and it also concedes that any disclosures to HHSC or the OIG were done by a third party, Ms. Morgan, or by Heidi Group itself. In United States versus Jacobson, the Supreme Court held that private actors cannot violate the Fourth Amendment. In that case, employees of a private freight carrier opened a passenger's package and then gave that open package to government officials without being asked or directed to do so. The court held that the private actor search there, even if it was unreasonable, and even if it was deliberate, did not constitute a search by a government actor. There was no Fourth Amendment violation. The same is true here. Ms. Morgan is a private actor who unilaterally went onto Heidi Group systems, unilaterally provided documents to OIG. She was not directed, she was not instructed, she was not asked to do so. Heidi Group effectively concedes this point. It does not allege that any government employee accessed its own systems, downloaded any files, obtained or modified any of its documents, or otherwise expanded the scope of the so-called search beyond what Ms. Morgan provided to the OIG employees. Instead, Heidi Group essentially hangs its entire case on one email sent by one OIG official, Mr. Dacus, to Ms. Morgan, in which he signed off with the words, "much appreciated." Heidi Group indicates that these two words, "much appreciated," showed that there was intentional encouragement from OIG to Ms. Morgan, such that it created an agreement and a conspiracy to break the law. Simply put, there was no Fourth Amendment violation here. I'll turn now to the expectation of privacy.
Can we pause on that for a second? If Dacus had said, "please go search the Dropbox," would that be a Fourth Amendment violation?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. That's a bit outside the scope of the briefing, since Heidi Group did not plead that Ms. Morgan became a government actor or a state actor for purposes of this search.
I'm trying to understand the legal principle. Is your legal view that if a government official directs a private citizen to conduct a search, that's not a search in the Fourth Amendment sense?
We're not conceding that point. What I'm saying is that the initial intrusion, if done by a private actor, the case law at least indicates that that initial intrusion does not provide a search. That's certainly the case here. And on top of that, this isn't even a close question like you're asking, Your Honor, because there was no direction or control. There was no request to provide documents.
Well, we can get to it in a second, because I'm not saying that this is the same case, but obviously we care very deeply about the legal rules that apply to your case, but also to other cases. And this isn't supposed to be a trick question. It strikes me as uncontroversial that if a government official directs a private citizen to conduct a search, that is absolutely a search. I'm unaware of any authority that would suggest otherwise or that would even make it close or debatable. Am I missing something? I don't mean it to be a trick question.
No, Your Honor, I think that's correct. Again, that's a little bit outside the scope of the brief since the parties did not claim that she became a state actor for these purposes or engaged in a Fourth Amendment search. But what we're looking at here, again, is that initial intrusion.
Sure.
The case law, at least, is clear on the point that a private party who performs an initial intrusion, even if it was unreasonable, and even if it was deliberate, that does not actually constitute a Fourth Amendment search.
Sure, and I don't think that's debated either. It strikes me that the debate is, what do we make of the involvement of Mr. Dacus in the search? So if there are two polar opposites to the doctrine, one, Mr. Dacus says, please search the Dropbox. That is clearly a search. The alternative is that Ms. Morgan does it without ever telling Mr. Dacus, has no involvement with Mr. Dacus, never met Mr. Dacus, never emailed Mr. Dacus, just totally on her own, does it herself, and turns it over. That looks like Jacobson. And so the question then is, where do you draw the line in between those two polar sides to the doctrine? One is clearly a search, one's clearly not. This case is obviously somewhere in the middle. And I guess what I'm struggling with is, given the alleged involvement of Mr. Dacus with the search, why is it not more like our decision in Cordova-Espinoza?
If I understand Your Honor's point correctly, you're trying to see where that sphere actually, where that scale actually lies.
Mm-hmm.
Again, this is not a close case, so I would urge you to accept the court's ruling in Jacobson and understand that the private intrusion, the initial private intrusion here does not constitute a search. To the extent that Mr. Dacus's email signed off with much appreciated provides the intentional encouragement that would require us to view Ms. Morgan as a state actor, mm-hmm. I think we still fail under the Fourth Amendment analysis because we're up on qualified immunity. We have to go through each of the prongs of the qualified immunity test. So even if we concede that there was a search here, which the state does not, we do have to look now to see whether it was a clearly established right of privacy at the time that that alleged search did occur. It was Heidi Group's burden to show that the agency employee's receipt of these documents, that Mr. Dacus's email, was clearly unlawful. Heidi Group was required to provide existing precedents to this court that the unconstitutionality of the employee's conduct was beyond debate. They certainly have not done that here. Heidi Group does not identify any precedent, in fact, showing a reasonable expectation of privacy in documents that it voluntarily shared with a private third party. In fact, Supreme Court case law has consistently held that there is no reasonable expectation of privacy in information that a party voluntarily turns over to a third party. We see that in the United States versus Miller case. We see that in the Smith versus Maryland case. We again see that in the United States versus Jacobson case. Here, Heidi does admit that it continuously provided access to its systems to Ms. Morgan, private third party, and that she maintained access privileges to its documents for nearly a year after her separation. Heidi Group also does not show any precedent that there is a clearly established right to privacy in documents that it has voluntarily contracted to provide to agency employees.
I'm troubled by that second point, but can we start with your first point? So they don't have any reasonable expectation of privacy as to Ms. Morgan.
Right.
That makes perfect sense. But that's not the question, right? The question is, do they have a reasonable expectation of privacy as to HHSC? And they never gave HHSC access to the documents, right? And we can talk about your contract point in a second because I'm troubled by that too, but that it strikes me, just take it outside of the 1 year after the contract expires and everything else. They just have an ongoing business relationship, right? So there's lots of people using the folders, everybody's working on it. That does not mean, I don't think, that there would be no 4A violation if a government agent just showed up and said, well, you're sharing it with third parties, so we're here just to take it, right? That would be a silly argument. I would think you would agree with me. So I don't understand why sharing with Ms. Morgan does anything to advance the state's position. It strikes me that you end up right back where you were before, which is, what do we do with the involvement of, I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing the surname, Dacus or Dacus? What's the correct pronunciation? Do you know?
Well, I think in your hypothetical, Judge Oldham, the government has to show up at the premises and take documents. That's certainly not what happened here, as you indicated. The government never actually came and took documents. They provided them to Ms. Morgan. In terms of the actual expectation of privacy as related to the government officials, that is why the contract point is so important.
So let's talk about that. So the contract just says you agree to share documents with us. What would happen if, now go out, take, I don't want to talk about this case for a second, I'm going to give you a hypothetical. We're just, under the contract, HHSC comes and says, hey, we'd really like to see files 1, 2, and 3. Does that mean that the Heidi Group would have had to turn over documents 1, 2, and 3?
Per the terms of the contract, yes.
Or breach the contract?
Yes.
Right, but they could have just walked away, right?
Well, but the question I believe that you're getting at, and certainly as it's been briefed in this case, is whether or not there was an expectation of privacy in those documents.
Sorry, we're talking about a different thing. I'm talking about just the contract point now. Like, if I agree, if you and I sign a contract, right, and I say, hey, I'm going to sell you my car. I'm going to sell you my car for $1,000. And you say, that sounds great. And then you come to take my car, and I go, you know what, I've changed my mind. Now, you might sue me for breach of contract, but you don't get to take my car.
Yes, but in your hypothetical, you would at least have the expectation that you'd be walking away with a car. And the same is true here. There is an expectation because of the contract terms that they would have an obligation to provide the government these very...
Or walk from the contract. See, that's the thing that I'm hung up on, is that because the contract is just it's an agreement between the Heidi Group and HHSC. HHSC has a right, no doubt, I'm with you, I'm agreeing with you, contractual right to say, I want to see documents 1, 2, and 3. But Heidi Group doesn't, it's not like you get specific performance of that contract term, right? If you come and ask for the documents, Heidi Group obviously has a right to say, okay, well, I don't really want to share with you with 1, 2, and 3, I'd rather just breach the contract and deal with whatever the damages are for that.
So I think the damages for that might be that the government can still conduct an investigation audit. They would obviously have other ways to do that. Statutory mechanisms would come into play. But we don't think we even have to get there. Under the terms of the contract, there is an expectation of privacy that the agency will request this information and that agency employees will actually be looking at the documents that are specifically laid out in the contract.
Could the agency have subpoenaed the documents?
Under statute, yes, I believe that is available, although, again, we don't even need to get to that point because they have the contractual right to seek those documents at any time.
If the agency had subpoenaed the documents, what rights would Heidi Group have had procedurally to quash the subpoena?
I believe any procedural rights that are available to a party who is being subpoenaed would apply to Heidi Group. I don't have any indication from the record that...
But they would have some rights.
Sure.
And so it's obviously not the same, right? If you subpoena the documents and Heidi Group has rights to fight the subpoena or walk away or terminate the contract or deal with termination breach, whatever it is, that is not the same as you asking a private party to go get the documents for you and avoid all of the procedural protections that would otherwise apply, right? They're just different circumstances.
Different circumstances. I agree with that. The subpoena point, I believe, primarily goes to the fact that the agency could access these documents outside of other agreements. I don't actually think it goes to the expectation of privacy that we're discussing. The expectation of privacy, I think, squarely lands within the parties' contractual obligations to each other.
Well, my point was, it wasn't made verbally, but you could go get a subpoena based on the contract. So we're investigating, we're entitled to see these documents, we want a subpoena, and then Heidi Group could say whatever it wanted to say, but the contractual obligation might support a subpoena.
The contractual obligations do not require a subpoena. So to the extent that I misspoke earlier, the subpoena would be provided under a statutory ability to seek these documents. The contract allows the agency and agency employees to enter the premises.
Well, you go to court and say they're in breach of contract. We demand that we see these documents. We're investigating. You can get a court order.
Yes. I believe, as I indicated to Judge Oldham, I believe any of the typical process would be available to the Heidi Group and to the agency at this time. However, we don't even have to get there because the contractual obligations make it clear that the Heidi Group did have a privacy expectation that it would have to provide these very same documents to the agency at any time upon request. I do want to end our discussion today with the objectively unreasonableness point. This is obviously tied very closely to the other qualified immunity prongs that we've already discussed here. To defeat immunity, the plaintiffs needed to show that every reasonable officer would know that what he was doing was unlawful. Every reasonable officer has to know that what they're doing is unlawful under the standard. That's certainly not the case when the agency has the contractual right to seek the very documents that it's reviewing from a private party. And that's certainly not the case when a Heidi Group provided those very same documents to a private party continuously for nearly a year. It is certainly not objectively unreasonable for these agency officials in this circumstance. I see that my time has expired, Your Honors. We do ask that the court reverse and remand for dismissal of the remaining claims. Thank you.
May it please the court. This case involves a question about whether an administrative entity of the state of Texas can discriminate against an entity because of its religious pro-life views, and in the course of that, violate that entity's Fourth Amendment rights to be free from an unlawful search and seizure under the Fourth Amendment. That's the overall case structure. What's before the court today is much narrower than that, and that is whether or not the administrative entity involved here had the right to violate the Fourth Amendment rights of the Heidi Group to be free from an unreasonable search and seizure. And by knowing that it couldn't do that, it couldn't just automatically go out and search and seize documents without violating the Fourth Amendment, did it instead have the right then to collude with a disgruntled third-party former employee of the Heidi Group and aid, encourage, abet, and conspire with that party to go in and access Dropbox documents that party still retained some access to? It was a naked access. It was not access privileges under the contract she had with the Heidi Group. But nevertheless, did the state have the right to be able to circumvent the Fourth Amendment protections against an unlawful search and seizure by conspiring with that third party? Now, we would agree with the state that if this had been a case involving just Phyllis Morgan went out, got a bunch of documents from the Heidi Group's Dropbox, and then just happened to drop them off over at the state's office, then we wouldn't be here today. That would not be a violation. But as Judge Oldham, as you were pointing out there, this is kind of between the two polar extremes. And instead, Mr. Dacus actually knew about what it was that Phyllis Morgan was doing, knew Phyllis Morgan was a former employee, knew that Phyllis Morgan was obtaining the documents without consent of the Heidi Group, but nevertheless encouraged her to go ahead and do so and said, much appreciated, thank you. And then in December of 2018, I believe it was, actually followed up with another email, said, do you still have that access? And twice more, Phyllis Morgan provided additional documents in December of 2018 and March of 2019. Now, the state has talked a lot about the Jacobson case and how the Jacobson case specifically says they could do what they were doing. But they left out something that they put in their actual brief, and it's on page 13 of the state's initial brief, quoting the Jacobson case. Jacobson said, unless a private individual is, quote, acting as an agent of the government or with the participation or knowledge of a government official, the Fourth Amendment does not apply. Unless they're doing that, then the Fourth Amendment doesn't apply. But in this case, they were doing that. They did know about exactly what Phyllis Morgan's role was in here. They were participating with her. They were engaging in her. They were actively aiding and abetting her in doing what she was doing. And they were reaping the benefits of that. The facts that we've alleged in the petition and that we had evidence in there showing is that this investigation was initiated, I think it was July 6th of 2018, within 2 days or so of that. That's immediately after Phyllis Morgan was terminated. And so if you go, she immediately went to the state, she offered her assistance and she provided documents. And then in the state's termination announcement and letter in October of 2018, the audit that actually came out in 2019 says the investigation was initiated by an anonymous source on July 6th, 2018. Is that coincidence? I don't think so. Phyllis Morgan is the anonymous source who initiated this and got the state involved in looking at all these issues, and they just believed what Phyllis Morgan was saying and doing, and so they relied on it. They got the documents, and it wasn't until after they have had actually proceeded with giving their 2019 final audit, alleging, at least by implication, a lot of fraud, $1.5 million in damages, all based on the spurious claims of Phyllis Morgan. It took another year and a half before they finally pared that down and said that there's really only about $100,000 that you're not able to support, no fraud, but therefore, under the circumstances, we did not even do what we should have been doing for oversight. We're not going to make you pay it back. So this case is a situation that's very different from what you see throughout the briefing by the state of just simply a third party voluntarily providing documents to the state that just passively receives them but doesn't get involved at all in the proceedings trying to do that. And so because of all that, we believe that this case does fall within the scope of what Jacobson's talking about. There was active participation, there was collusion, there was conspiracy, and therefore the state is liable for that. Ms. Jackson pivoted over to the question about whether there's a reasonable expectation of privacy, and I'd like to address that. Under the reasonable expectation of privacy rules, there are a number of cases. For qualified immunity, which is what this is really before the court today, qualified and official immunity, qualified has two prongs to it. The first of them is there has to have been some violation of law. And the state's sole objection to the Fourth Amendment violation of law standard is that there was no reasonable expectation of privacy in those documents at Dropbox that Phyllis Morgan accessed. There is a violation that's alleged. The first prong of qualified immunity, of our burden to disprove qualified immunity, is met because we did show that there is a Fourth Amendment violation. There's also the reasonable expectation of privacy that they contest comes from the progeny of the Fourth Amendment. And the district court found that the right of privacy was in the progeny of the Fourth Amendment as well as in the CFAA, Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. The right of privacy that's in the Fourth Amendment, we've got a lot of cases that talk about that in the brief. I want to address just very briefly, though, the district court also said there's a right of privacy in the CFAA. The district court held that Heidi did not have a private right of action under the CFAA. They did not say that Phyllis Morgan did not violate the CFAA. The CFAA is a criminal statute. It provides a right of privacy if there's a $5,000 threshold for damages, which Heidi was not able to show. But the CFAA did provide the right of privacy that underlies the Fourth Amendment. The district court held that. That was not appealed. That was not objected to by the state. In fact, if the court looks at the state's objections to the district court decision, the CFAA is not even mentioned anywhere in their entire objection, much less was there any specific objection to the district court's finding and the magistrate's finding that the CFAA provided a right of privacy. Texas Penal Code 33 also provides a right of privacy. Now, the magistrate and the district court rejected that premise by saying that the Texas Code Chapter 33 really doesn't apply under a 1983 act because it's not federal law. And we agree with that general proposition that there has to be federal law, but the federal law involved in the 1983 Act claim is the violation of the Fourth Amendment. That is the federal law. The right of privacy doesn't have to be based expressly on federal law. In fact, in the cases that we cite in our brief, United States versus Jones, the United States Supreme Court said that you have to look outside the Fourth Amendment to what is a right of privacy. That was then followed up with by the Fifth Circuit in the Katz and the Carpenter case, by the United States Supreme Court in the Katz and the Carpenter cases. And so what you've got is the Supreme Court saying right of privacy has to come outside of the Fourth Amendment. Justice Harlan, in his concurring opinion in the Katz decision, expressly said that really what the right of privacy does is it's what does society really accept as a privacy right. That concurring opinion then got turned around in Carpenter to being the major opinion, where the court said that basically a right of privacy is what does society recognize as something that should be private. Both on the federal and state level, through the CFAA and Chapter 33, the society has recognized that there is a right to privacy in computer records. And so the right of privacy is there. The cases that I guess it's the Katz case that I talked about, that there's a violation of the Fourth Amendment. That's also been applied by this court in the Katropia and Zeta cases. And in fact, the Zeta case, this court says that for a search to be constitutional, the subject must be afforded the opportunity to obtain pre-compliance review before a neutral decision maker. That gets into what is the clearly established law that Ms. Jackson also talked about. The state argues that there is no clearly established law that says that an administrative agent can't circumvent the Fourth Amendment by going out and colluding with a third party in order to access Dropbox records that third party, when an employee, had a right to access. They're right. There's not a case that says that yet. And so the question is, does that mean that that's not a clearly established rule? No. The United States Supreme Court in the Katz case said that it is a per se violation of the Fourth Amendment to go get documents without getting a warrant and an opportunity for pre-compliance review and objection. In the C versus Seattle case, the United States Supreme Court said it is settled law that an administrative agency cannot go get those kind of documents without pre-compliance judicial review before a neutral third party. So what they say is, well, notwithstanding that, there's all these cases that say you have to have this very high level of particularity for a decision exactly on point. All of those cases deal with in the field probable cause decisions that have to be made by a police officer in a life-threatening split-second decision. And they talk about all those cases, and they say that because of that, we really have to have a case exactly on point. The United States Supreme Court says, no, that's not true. One of the cases they cited was the Lanier case, and they said that Lanier case says that you've got to have clarity to the specific conduct in question. That phrase is taken completely out of the context of the Lanier case, which was actually pointing out the exact opposite. In the Lanier case, the court was saying that general rules often are able to provide the specific clarity necessary to determine the particular conduct in question. And so it's the opposite of what they've actually cited the case for. It actually supports that the settled law per se violations were clearly established. So where do they pivot from that? They say, well, wait a minute, we had a right under the contract and under our subpoena power to go do exactly what we did. Since we could have gotten those documents through a subpoena or by just going in and showing up immediately and unannounced and taking those documents, then it's really not any kind of violation of right of privacy to instead ask Phyllis Morgan go do our dirty work for us. The United States Supreme Court in the Van Buren case has a little footnote reference in there that says, just because a person, an administrative agent, could walk down the hall and get a physical copy of a document does not excuse hacking into their computer system in order to get the same documents. They have to follow the rules to get the documents that they're trying to rely on. But beyond that, and this kind of gets to some of what you're questioning, Judge Oldham, the subpoena power is not nearly as broad as what is suggested by the state here. The administrative code provisions under the Texas Administrative Code that they cite that gives them subpoena power to go and subpoena the documents they're requesting specifically says that if there's not compliance, you don't get to go and just take the documents. You have to file a lawsuit, and then you have to show good cause for those documents before a neutral third party. And this also isn't a question, Judge Oldham, where they said we want documents 1, 2, and 3. If that had been the case, then perhaps we might have been able to respond and say, well, neutral third party judge, item number 1 isn't a contract document at all. It has nothing to do with this, and therefore it's not something that they're entitled to. And document number 3 is an attorney-client privilege document, and therefore we have the right to avoid providing that. Document 2, okay, we'll give it to you. But they didn't do that. They didn't identify any documents. They just said, Phyllis, go do it. Go get whatever documents you can, whatever documents you want, provide them to us. Doesn't matter whether they have anything to do with the contract. Doesn't matter whether it has anything to do with provision of healthcare services. Doesn't matter whether it's privileged. Doesn't matter anything. We'll be the judge once we get those of whether we like them or not. That is not the standard. The subpoena power, the subpoena rules, the per se CATS provision that there has to be an opportunity for a pre-compliance review and objection, those rules all say you've got to come before a neutral third party. You can't just go and get the documents. Moreover, the contract is also not as broad as they suggest. It does have limitations on some of the things, and I've got those pointed out in the brief as well. So what they say deprives the court, deprives the right of privacy, simply is not the fact, and it's not what happened in this case at all either. We made a point in our brief about the fact that the questions that are before the court have been waived. And we cite a number of different cases about how you had to bring the issue before the magistrate, first of all in the motion to dismiss, then you have to object to the magistrate's opinion, and then you have to raise it in the court of a point of appeal to the Court of Appeals. They didn't do the first two things. They did not raise most of these issues that they're relying on in either the magistrate or to the district court. And what they've tried to do to get around all that in their response, their reply brief, is they've cited the Yee versus City of Escondido, I think it was, case where the United States Supreme Court says all you really have to do is generally reference the underlying statute. So if you're saying it's Fourth Amendment, all you have to do is reference Fourth Amendment, and then you can make almost any argument you want to the court. That's the standard in the Supreme Court. That is not the standard in the courts of appeals. In this, in the Tenth Circuit, in its decision in Braun versus Medtronic, specifically pointed out that distinction between the Supreme Court and the courts of appeals. The Medtronic Braun case, the Tenth Circuit cited Singleton versus Wolf. This court, Fifth Circuit, has cited Singleton versus Wolf in the Carson, HECI, and General Fund cases. General Land Office cases, all that basically say that the courts of appeals make their own decisions about what is going to be allowed on appeal, and they can't you can't just bring it up at whatever you want. This court has made those decisions. They're all cited in our initial brief where we object to on the grounds of waiver. They have to have brought it to the attention of the magistrate first. They then have to have brought it to the district court in their objection, and then they can rely on that before this court. They didn't do any of that. There is an expectation of privacy. There is a waiver of their decisions. The other thing that I would point to is the court is all, the state is also asking for pendant jurisdiction on two claims, one our Fourth Amendment claim and the other being our state court claim under Section 106.01 of Civil Practice and Remedies Code. And the Fourth Amendment one is part of the qualified immunity, so if the court determines it has jurisdiction, notwithstanding the waiver to determine qualified immunity, then it also has jurisdiction to consider the Fourth Amendment claim. That does not apply with respect to the 106.01 claim, which is completely extraneous to what's involved in this qualified immunity appeal. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. A few quick points on rebuttal. First, my friend on the other side of the aisle does describe the relationship between Mr. Dacus and Ms. Morgan in a way that is completely outside of the record. The agency and Mr. Dacus never asked Ms. Morgan to provide any documents. It certainly did not provide the roving request that opposing counsel indicated. It did not control, it did not engage, it did not encourage and abet Ms. Morgan to provide these documents. This certainly isn't a hacking case as described by opposing counsel. And in response to the 1-2-3 hypothetical that Judge Oldham laid out, the agency did ask for these documents. There were years of investigations and audits that occurred because of Heidi Group's financial mismanagement. So it's completely false to say that the agency never went to Heidi Group to ask for the documents. It certainly did that, and the audit and investigation reports show that Heidi Group provided voluminous documents to the agency, so it's completely false to indicate that this was the only way that they could get them was to request that Ms. Morgan go out on her own and get these documents for them. That's completely false. Number two, it does not matter that Ms. Morgan was the anonymous tip, as opposing counsel indicated. OIG exists to prevent fraud, waste, and abuse in government programs, especially the government programs that Heidi Group contracted to provide to the people of Texas here. OIG frequently receives anonymous tips and allegations to investigate fraud, so none of this was out of the usual. And Heidi Group was entrusted with millions of taxpayer dollars to be able to provide the programs that it agreed to provide. It drastically underperformed on those promises, and so it was investigated for its mismanagement and contract compliance issues. Third, as to the right of privacy, opposing counsel is correct. It does not need to be based on federal law. That's true. But it has to be clearly established through a robust consensus of law. As indicated, opposing counsel has provided zero precedent to this court to look to show that it was a clearly established right, that Heidi Group had a clearly established right to privacy in documents that it voluntarily shared with a third party and had a contractual obligation to provide to the agency and did, in fact, provide to agency investigators multiple times. Their assertion, relying on CATS, is an attempt to rely on the general contours of the Fourth Amendment. This court in Wernicke versus Garcia already rejected that argument. And regardless, that argument completely flies in the face of the Supreme Court's requirement that clearly established law must be articulated with specificity, especially in the Fourth Amendment context. Finally, Your Honors, if you'll indulge me, I do want to take a moment to talk about the forfeiture issues. Opposing counsel indicates that we essentially waived all of our immunity defenses because we allegedly did not raise them below. However, I have record sites for the court. There are at least 9 places below where both parties grappled with the immunity issues. First record site is record site 91 to 94. That's in our original answer. We discuss qualified and other immunity defenses. And record site 252, to 255 and 257 to 259. That's the motion for judgment on the pleadings of the individual defendants raising the qualified immunity defenses. At record 253 to 254 and 259 to 261, the individual defendant's motion for judgment on the pleadings cites to its official immunity defenses. At record 423 to 425, 430 to 436, Heidi Group responds to the individual defendant's motion to judgment on the pleadings, also citing the qualified immunity defenses. Heidi Group again responds to the official immunity defenses at record 425 to 426, 436 to 439. Finally, Your Honors, at record 476 to 483, the defendant's reply also cites the qualified immunity defenses, and 483 to 485, the defendants again cite the official immunity defenses. Opposing counsel also indicates that we did not raise these in the objections to the report and recommendations from the magistrate judge. That is false. At record 735 to 736, all defendants responded to the qualified and official immunity defenses. Unless the court has further questions, I'll see the remainder of my time.
I do have a question.
Yes, Judge.
on the claim that there's no factual support for Heidi Group's claim that there was collusion or collaboration between Ms. Morgan and the state defendants, on page 20 of the complaint, Heidi Group alleges that Ms. Morgan sent an email that said, "You mentioned if I were to get more information to send you so that the organization can appropriately evaluate the spending within the organization and misuse of dollars," that this shows that the state defendants knew and were aware that she was going back to get more documents. If we're here on a 12B6 standard, which applies to the motion for judgment on the pleadings, hasn't Heidi Group sufficiently pled enough?
So under this court's precedent in the Morgan versus Swanson case, the court does accept as true well-pleaded facts on this exact posture and interlocutory appeal denying qualified immunity. However, it does not have to accept legal conclusions, conclusory allegations, or statements made without justification. To the extent that those allegations fall into one of those categories, we would ask the court to not consider those.
Thank you.
Thank you.